My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression Voices. I'm your host, Greg. Today I have with me Stephanie Lauritsen. Stephanie is maybe better known in the world. This is not to her parents, of course, but better known in the world as the Mormon Child Bride, which is the blog that she runs quite deftly. And Stephanie, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I'm excited.
I am excited too. So tell us about the Mormon Child Bride blog, and how your life works in duplicate.
The Mormon Child Bride was a blog I started shortly after I got married. The name comes from the fact that growing up, I would always tell my mother I was never ever going to be one of those Mormon child brides who meets her husband at age 19 and gets married and has a bunch of kids. I wasn't going to do that. And then I met my husband when I was 19 and I got married. And as the whole internet now knows, I'm having his baby. So, you know, never, never say never. But anyway,
You're not 19 anymore.
I'm not 19 anymore. Yeah. Now I'm 25. So, you know, I'm slightly more adult, but that's where the name came from. And I found now that I usually use Stephanie Child Bride, like on Facebook, and on my blog. And I've started to identify with that as my name in a weird, perverse way. Stephanie Child Bride, almost to the point where when people ask me my name, I'm tempted to say, "Hi, I'm Stephanie Childbride." And my poor last name, Stephanie Lauritsen, has kind of gotten pushed aside. And I didn't realize that I now feel like I'm kind of two different people. And I realized that the most last week when my sister invited me on Facebook to the H&M store opening in Salt Lake. And you have to accept the invitation on Facebook and then bring the little ticket that said, you know, Stephanie Child Bride is coming to this event. And they also were having alcoholic beverages at said event, so you needed to bring your ID. And there was this very, very funny moment where I gave my ticket to the man taking tickets, and he's like, "What's your name?" And Stephanie Child Bride. And he crossed it off the list, and he laughed at it a little bit. But then when I had to show my ID, Stephanie Lauritsen, the names didn't match. And there was this brief confusion where I had to frantically explain that Stephanie Child Bride is like my weird internet alias and Stephanie Lauritsen is my given name. And on the way home, I started to think like, well, which one am I? Am I Stephanie Child Bride who reveals a lot of stuff about herself on the internet? Or am I Stephanie Lauritsen who is maybe, in my mind, a more private individual? And the fact that I'm starting to identify more as Stephanie Child Bride, because I think that's my more honest self, weirdly enough. Stephanie Lauritsen is my socially acceptable self.
Personal revelations and honesty go hand in hand.
Yeah, I guess so. And, you know, Stephanie Child Bride is definitely the more honest incarnation. And a little bit, I may be more sarcastic and grumpy with my internet self than maybe in real life, but not by a lot.
Not let me just reassure you of that. Not by a whole lot.
Not by a whole bunch.
Unless I only know the internet self.
I don't even know who people know anymore. But I think you know the real self. I think Stephanie Child Bride, weirdly enough, has morphed into a more accurate description of who I am as a person. Whereas before, it totally wasn't the case. It was just a funny title, blog name, you know. Psychologically, if there are any psychology people listening, I'm sure they're just having a heyday on what all of that means, but whatever.
Well, I'm interested for a few minutes before we start talking about all the formative experiences of Stephanie as a child prior to Bride. I'm interested to know what you think about your blogging, about how, you know, you start blogging and you're typing out into the internet ether and you don't think anybody's listening. And then one day you probably started to realize, oh, there are some people listening. You've received some press.
Yeah, a little bit. Not a ton. The first time I realized people were listening, if that's the direction your question is going.
I'm interested in how that combines with the cloak of anonymity and how fame, if you consider yourself famous, adjusts that.
Like, no, I got to put that up. Like, I don't consider myself famous in any way. I consider myself a topic of conversation that people have, you know, about me. There are some people who like to talk about me, and it's a very small group. Well, the first time I realized people were listening was when I accidentally, I'm listening a little, wrote a blog post about something my sister heard in Young Women's. And because I felt like I was totally anonymous and no one was reading my blog, I openly talked about how I hated what my sister had heard in Young Women's. And little did I know, those Young Women leaders were aware that I had a blog and were reading it.
Wow.
And it caused a huge, not huge, I mean, in my life, everything is huge. It caused a, you know, small scale conflict where, you know, they're saying that's not what we meant. We didn't mean that. And, you know, it was really rude of you to, you know, tell people that we'd said these things when you weren't there and you're hearing it secondhand and to put this evil twist on it. And, you know, to their credit, they were right.
Did that conversation happen online in your blog comments, or did it happen in real life?
No, that was in real life. Well, surprisingly, the Young Woman's leader who objected to what I had said showed up at my parents' house. And I just happened by coincidence to be there. And she was very upset, which she had a right to be. I mean, if I've been misrepresented on the internet several times. And so I get that that hurts. And I learned a lot from that. You do have to be careful about what you say. But it was interesting because she sort of went on a smear campaign and told everyone about what an awful thing I had done and sent people to my website. And then all of a sudden, I went from having like my mom and my sister and maybe like the off college roommate reading my blog to having quite the audience of people who did not like me. So that's how my blog actually, that's where my first bump in numbers came from, where all these people who wanted to be upset with me were reading my blog. And, you know, somehow that shifted
to a friendly audience?
Yeah, to a more friendly audience. And, you know, but that did, for a long time, I was very hesitant to say exactly what I thought. And I wrote very veiled posts at the beginning. I mean, I was, you know, 21, 22, that hinted at things, but was very careful not to outwardly say, I don't like this about, you know, something, and I think this is wrong. And it did lead to me censoring myself a little bit. And part of that is good. I mean, it's not very nice to go onto the internet every time you're mad at someone and say this person's an idiot. So, you know, that's just social graces and that's just not nice. But I did get to a point eventually where I realized I could be discontented with the church and still be a nice person about it. Now, and I think that's where I am now, hopefully.
Yeah, and that's I think that that's probably pretty accurate. The mix of your blog is not entirely churchy.
No.
And I don't know how that has evolved over time.
Yeah, I think it's much more churchy than it ever was ever before. In the last maybe year and a half, it's become very, I think the label on my blog is Mormon Rage or something like that, or Crazy Mormon Thoughts. But for me, and I think any person who is raised in the church can identify with this a little bit, Mormonism sort of seeps into all parts of your life, and all parts of your life seep into Mormonism.
Yes.
And so I talk about teaching, and I talk about reality television and books, or things that I like, or random things that, you know, my brother does. But they're all interconnected somehow. But I felt finally comfortable putting the church stuff in there because that's there, you know. And I was, you know, raised Mormon and to a certain extent still identify as Mormon. And I realized that it was unfair not to write about that part of my life. If I was going to talk about reality TV, which is a little part of my life, I should probably be comfortable talking about Mormonism.
That is a big part of your life.
Yeah, yeah. It is.
Speaking of reality TV... Another bump in your ratings.
Ah, it was crazy. Okay, cool.
So what happened there?
I don't even know. I mean, honestly, the internet is a bizarre place because I write things sometimes and I think, uh-oh, this is going to get me in trouble, and then I hit publish anyway. I did not have any feelings whatsoever that would be the case with my post on Mormon douchebags. I thought, a couple of my friends will think this is funny, and it will be one of those little posts that, you know, not a lot of people react to. And it just exploded out of my control, exploded.
Experienced firsthand the phrase going viral.
Seriously. And I never thought that would happen. And I seriously doubt that it will happen again, but it was strange how people reacted to that post, because it was either extremely positive or extremely, extremely negative, and it was bizarre.
Okay, let's give a quick background on what the post was and what prompted it, what you said.
I was talking about Bentley Williams, who was a contestant on The Bachelorette, who is just an absolute douchebag.
Yeah, let's just face it. Let's just call it like it is.
Yeah, and I don't care how many people email me or have emailed me to be like, oh, I knew Bentley in college, he's a nice guy. No, lies. He's a douche. And I wrote a post about how Bentley Williams actually fits a prototype in the Mormon culture community of a Mormon douchebag. He's not this isolated case of a random bad guy. There are some parts of our Mormon culture that foster and develop lots of Mormon douchebags. And not intentionally, but it happens. It's like a weird toxic waste byproduct of the church, is that you're going to get some guys that fit this. And I talked about how Mormon douchebags like to skew or maybe emphasize parts of Mormon doctrine to fit an agenda which is not supportive of women and is not supportive of anything outside very, very traditional and stereotyped gender roles. So I said, for example, that Mormon douchebags will love President Benson's talk about, you know, to mothers in Zion, where it says women get away from the typewriters, because that means that there's one more spot for him in his medical school program. You know, not because he really believes that program doctrine, but because that's a chance for him to get ahead. And people responded very negatively to that, I think. That was one of the things people didn't like that I said, that maybe we don't actually believe certain doctrines, but they're convenient for us. And I also got a lot of responses saying, like, why do you hate stay-at-home moms so much? Which is bizarre to me, and I don't know how they got to that conclusion from reading that post, but I got a lot of that. Oh, why do you hate motherhood?
Well, let's face it, you got a lot of positive responses, too.
True.
This is how we got to know you. And we became aware of the existence of Stephanie, child bride, as a result of the Bentley post. And,
yeah,
you know, Letty and I probably read through 160 comments or something like that. And you got a lot of people pulling for you.
Yeah, no, and I should not ever underemphasize that. What was amazing to me were the responses from people who are like, I married this guy, you know, and like, it's true. I dated him. I got a surprising number of those. Like, I've divorced him now, but I want you to know I married and divorced this guy.
And we're not talking about Bentley specifically, although ironically those responses came in too. We're talking about this prototype, this.
Yeah.
What did you call it? You called it, like, you gave it a scientific name, didn't you?
I gave it a quasi-scientific name because I'm functionally illiterate, like Mormon Maximus douchebag or something. I can probably look it up.
Yeah, you're like you're banging pretty hard on that keyboard. I can
hear.
Oh,
I don't mean to. That's sorry. Okay. I stopped banging on the sorry, listeners.
No, that's okay.
Mormon Maximus douchebag, something like that. Like yeah. Homo sapien, I don't know. Anyway, and I gave like I tried to set it up from the best of my ability from those categorizations in like eighth grade when you learn about, you know, something is a species and it has a something else, like categorizing it. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, and it's reminiscent of Jeff Foxworthy's, like, you know, you're a redneck if, kind
yeah,
of, right?
Yeah. And so I also did that kind of deliberately to sort of take out the emotional aspect of it. Like, if we talk about it in vaguely scientific, even fake scientific terms, I wanted to make it clear that I'm not really talking about Bentley Williams or a specific human individual. I'm talking about traits, character yeah. traits that a person might have. Although, full disclosure, he'll never ever hear this, and so I feel fine saying it. The douchebag post was inspired mostly by my good friend's ex-boyfriend, and I just wanted the internet to know that.
Who also wears $300 jeans.
Yeah, and is an awful human being. And if he ever does hear this, he'll know who he is. And every time full disclosure, also, I have advertisers, and I make like nothing from those advertisers. But the month that I had the douchebag post, I made enough to buy, I like to sew, I'm a craft enthusiast. I had enough money to buy some really, really beautiful fabric. So thank you, Bentley Williams. Thank you, internet. Thank you, my friend Lisa's ex-boyfriend, for that.
There you go. Anyway. There you go. All right. Well, let's go to the child part of life. Tell me, let's talk about your beginnings and your family in Mormonism and how did your family come into this delightful culture and faith?
Sure. Let's see. My parents are both, you know, pioneer ancestry, typical Mormon people. You know, we have the big Mormon family. All of my mother's siblings, with the exception of one, live within a 5-mile radius of each other, and they all have thousands of children. And so, you know, just I think my Mormon upbringing will be very familiar to anyone who grew up in Utah, hearing about great grandmas and great, 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 great grandmas who crossed the plains and made sacrifices to be here. And that's where I grew up. That said, my parents are hardcore Democrats and liberals. And so even early on in my existence, I knew that my parents were a little bit different than the other Mormon moms and dads, you know? And I heard my parents express discontent with the culture of Utah because it seemed, you know, they would get upset when they would say, oh, they're doing this because they're Republicans and it's actually going to hurt people. And, you know, my parents are nice people, but they're, you know, that's part of my life that I had growing up is hearing them say, you know, this isn't right. You know, what maybe the church is involved in, what political parties are involved in might not be the right thing to do. That said, you know, a big number of my family is also Republicans. And so I'm not trying to say that, you know, you're not a good person. I mean, I'm secretly sort of implying it, but I don't really mean that. you know, there are some awful people from all political parties and there are some wonderful people. But that was my growing up, is I always had this slightly quirky, yeah, we're Mormons, but we also actually really like Harry Reid instead of hating him, you know? And we actually don't love Mitt Romney. And there was a little bit of disconnect there. And then it got more confusing as I grew up when I realized that despite some little political quirks, my parents were very deeply and still are very faithful Mormons. But they recognized that there are some faults, but it didn't stop them from being very active in the church, and they still are. And so I think that's been the hardest thing for them and for me, is to take a different path where I recognize that things aren't right, but I'm not as inclined to stick it out as they are. I don't know if that makes sense. I feel like I'm rambling. I may need some direction here.
No, I think that that makes sense. And I think that that's obviously we want to sort of understand how that divergent viewpoint and how that different conclusion came to be. I think it is really interesting to understand, to hear people, because I just didn't even know, I still don't know how to wrap my brain around it, hear people talking about their more nuanced views. I have to force myself into nuanced views against my DNA, you know? And so no, I think we want to talk about that, but the development as your young feelings about the church are growing. Was there a point where you were completely drinking the Kool-Aid and you just were glowing with young womanhood?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, given my upbringing, and my parents are quirky, funny, weird people, and Mormons are not sometimes what I would consider quirky or weird people, but I was glowing to the best of my ability to glow. I definitely had some true blue Mormon moments, and even extensive time periods, but that was only possible from the very beginning. It was only possible to be a true blue believing Mormon if I rationalized or flat out ignored some other aspects of my personality.
And you were aware of that rationalization and ignoring?
Yes. I was very good at saying, you know, this is a problem, but it will work out eventually. You know, there will always be problems, but you have to endure to the end. The church is perfect, but the people aren't perfect. I had all of those little catchisms that I think any vaguely quirky Mormon might use from time to time. And I had things, I was very good at twisting words. I mean, my dad is an attorney. My mom is an English teacher. I've been able to manipulate words my entire life to mean what I want them to mean.
Yeah.
So when I approached something or heard something that I didn't maybe agree with right off, I would twist the words or twist the meaning into alternate interpretations. And to a certain extent, that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's maybe just a less positive way of likening the scriptures unto yourself. But to a large extent, if you do that too much, I think you're setting yourself up for a major breakdown. And that's exactly what happened to me. I got to the point where I couldn't find the right way to manipulate some words into a way that I could work for me. And it totally broke my heart. But I did. I mean, all growing up, I got married in the temple. I did all of the things. I have my personal progress award. I was, for the most part, very, very faithful, but it was because I could do that.
You weren't Stephanie the party girl?
No, I never had. I mean, there were moments of brief teenage rebellion, but I mean, that included like sneaking out one time and making out with my boyfriend. Like there was no, you know, major party.
Thumbs up
anything.
For that kind of rebellion, by the way.
I know. I mean, I think I picked the best type of rebellion possible because, as I know, no one has died or overdosed from making out. So, you know, good for me. I was always very practical about stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Church always has been, always was and always will be, I think, a practical thing for me. I don't maybe like going to the dentist, but I think it's good for me, and for a long time church was something I didn't like, but I believed was good for me.
Okay.
You know, so anyway,
where did that start to sort of unravel in a more serious way where you couldn't make it work anymore?
The first time I couldn't make it work and I tried so, so very hard was with the Prop 8 thing. And I mean, I was this young idealistic kid in college. I guess I'm still this young idealistic kid, but I was, you know, I was really young and I heard about the Prop 8 thing and I heard about how we were supposed to do, I mean, I looked up the letter to see exactly, so for manipulative purposes, I looked up the letter from, you know, the church on the issue, and it said something along the lines of, like, do everything you can to preserve the traditional family. And I immediately thought, well, I physically cannot call someone and say to vote for this, and I cannot support this. And so I'm scot-free. I can't do it. They said, do what you can, and I can't do it. I'm glad you find that funny. Like, it was ridiculous. I get that it was ridiculous, but I wanted to be a good Mormon. I mean, I have to emphasize that. I wanted to be a good Mormon, so I was going to try as hard as I possibly could to be a good Mormon, but I still could not, I couldn't do that. I couldn't say to these people, you can't love the person that you love, and you can't marry the person that you love, and you can't have the same rights as me. I couldn't do that, you know?
Where were you at school? Where were you?
I was at the University of Utah. I was, oddly enough, about to transfer to BYU so that I could do a study abroad program through their program, not permanently, but just to do this program. But I was at the U, and that was the other thing, is that I saw the other side of that. And I know that's the cliche to say, oh, I had gay friends or gay loved ones, because, you know, honestly, I didn't know a ton of people who were gay, but I saw that there was a community and that they were hurting.
Yeah, I don't think that that's a cliche, by the way. I want to press back gently on that.
Right.
It's not a cliche to have, you could tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think it's a cliche to say my experience with different people has taught me to have empathy for diversity.
Yeah.
I think that that's very human and important.
That's true. I guess the cliche comes from the guy who's totally racist and then claims he's not because he has a black friend. Like, I wanted to clarify that that's not what I was trying to say. I was trying to say but I agree with you. I mean, I saw a community that was hurting because of what was happening, and I couldn't be a part of it. It did not feel morally right to me to do that. And ironically, I mean, that was my church upbringing talking.
Yeah.
I mean, I could not imagine Jesus saying to a person, you don't really love the person that you love, you're just sinning. You know, or
right.
You should live your life alone because you're gay, basically.
Right.
I couldn't see the Savior do it, and I couldn't do it. And, you know, that is maybe another thing I need to clarify. I still really deeply believe in God, and I still believe that there is a Savior. I also believe in a Heavenly Mother figure. But, you know, that's still a way I live my life, is what would Jesus do? And I couldn't see Jesus doing that. So I couldn't do it either. But that was when things started to unravel, which was when I believed God wanted me to do one thing and the church wanted me to do another thing. And that's when the shit hit the fan. Sorry for people who are listening who don't like swears.
That's okay. We like that word on Mormon Expression. So
okay.
That's a very Utah word, you know. I think the polls have shown that that's the number one swear word in Utah.
Well, it's a good one. It was my third word. Said in sacrament when I bonked my head.
Interesting.
My third word in all of life, anyway.
Okay. Well, it's good that it's persisted with you.
Yes.
You were married at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, what we've kind of skipped forward. Are there other things sort of before that that really have to be addressed, or can we talk about kind of how that started to? Where do we need to go from here?
That's a bad person to ask someone who has ADD, because we can go anywhere and I can tie it all back at the end.
No, that's okay. But, so your husband, let's talk about Dan a little bit.
Also known as Spouse Man.
Also those. Known as Spouse Man to the...
So I call him that now too. We have these new identities. Sorry, go on.
I don't know if I feel comfortable imagining those scenarios. So, Spouse Man, you're so sexy. Dan is a very good looking guy, by the way. We've met Dan. We like Dan a lot. So Dan is very faithful.
Mm-hmm. Dan really loves the church.
Yeah, Dan really loves the church, right? So now, how you don't seem like the type of person to not have that conversation with him at that time.
We definitely had that conversation, and that was the first time Dan and I really deeply disagreed with a course of action, but not maybe in the way, in the traditional, I mean, Dan would never, I hesitate to speak for him, but knowing that we've had the conversation, I don't think Dan could ever say that gay people are evil or that gay people, you know, aren't truly gay, that they're choosing to be gay. Dan believes that gay people are gay, you know, that they legitimately have the feelings and attractions that they have, just like any straight person would have.
Right.
Where we disagreed was how gay LDS people should interact in the church. And he believes that, I think he believes the standard church line, but the friendly one. I think Elder Oaks put that out, you know, that we love gay people and they can still be active members of the church so long as they're not acting on their feelings and obeying the laws of chastity. I think that's essentially Dan's stance. And so he was opposed, and he was opposed to gay marriage because the church was opposed to gay marriage and he believes in the church. Over time, you know, and we tried to negotiate that. We tried to find some hybrid way to deal with that issue in a way that we could both be comfortable. And don't try that. There's no way. If you're struggling with that with a spouse or a significant other, there's no real way to compromise on that, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, maybe, okay, unpack that a little bit more. Compromise.
Like we would give exceptions, like, okay, you know, gay people can have civil. I think the best
you were
one
creating a philosophical framework that that tried to be inclusive of both of your points of view.
Right.
Okay.
And so, you know, we would think like, well, maybe we can agree on civil unions because, you know, we'd say, okay, we think they should have all the same rights as people, you know, to partner benefits and insurance and housing and jobs and all of that stuff and the right to adopt children. All of that we agreed that they should be able to have. Where we differed was the marriage issue. And so for a while it was like he would say, okay, I agree that they should have civil unions. And I would say, well, I agree that it should be a marriage. And then Dan said, well, maybe the state should just stop trying to monopolize marriage altogether and marriage should just be a religious thing.
What a miraculous concept that would be.
Yeah, I know.
How incredible it would be to not break the First Amendment.
Right.
Right.
Wouldn't
anymore.
It be great if we just, you know, didn't do that anymore?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we left off, that there was no solution to this that would work for both of us. And that I think to a more nuanced degree that I think maybe he would say, you know, I would believe that gay people can get married, whatever. He would say gay people can get married as long as Mormon churches aren't forced to recognize them or, you know, marry them in the temple. And I remind him that that was just fear-based rhetoric put by people that, you know, there's no way they're going to make, you know, some guy marry two gay people in the temple. But anyway, tangent.
That's not, but, I don't think that's a tangent. And by the way, I happen to sort of disagree with you on that.
Oh, okay.
Not that the church would ever be forced to. The church, I believe, this is your interview, but I believe that the church will eventually accept gay marriages in the temple because for the same reason that the church extended the priesthood to blacks, because it will self-destruct if not, and the rhetoric going in will not be the same rhetoric coming out of that revelation. And that's the way polygamy and the priesthood for the blacks was. The rhetoric going in was ludicrous and we all developed rhetorical amnesia. So
Well, I agree with you actually on that. I agree that it's at some point the church will have to accept the gay community, including gay marriage. But there's a difference between the church getting rhetorical amnesia and quote unquote changing their minds, and like some bishop being held at gunpoint by the SWAT team, Mary. Like, and that's what I think the rhetoric was going, being like, oh, they'll have, yeah.
That was just crazy talk. That was just Glenn Beck talk, which, that, as we all know, is Satan / crazy talk.
Yeah, and that's the rhetoric that I really rejected. But I think a lot of reasonable people heard that, thought, well, maybe that will happen, and got really scared. And anyway, but yes, I agree with you on the fact that eventually God is going to, again, quote unquote, change his mind on gay people. And actually, that's something I think Dan and I have talked about, is that, you know, Dan is more willing to wait for things. This is how it is now, but it's highly likely that God will change things. I just need to be faithful until that happens. Whereas my approach is more, you know, cheesy Gandhi quote, be the change that you want in the world and advocate for it and agitate for it.
You and I may potentially agree. Maybe we wouldn't, but my inclination is that God changes his mind faster when there's pressure from below.
Well, I've never really believed it's an issue of God changing his mind. I think God always wanted black people to have the priesthood. I think God always thought polygamy was a horrible misinterpretation of something, if he even said anything about it at all, and that God, of course, loves and accepts his gay children. So his mind is already where it ought to be, but we have to figure that out. That's a totally human condition.
So were you blogging at this point?
Yeah, and I actually refused.
Did this seep in?
No, actually, because there was so much cognitive dissonance that I did not know how to write about gay marriage at all. The first time in my entire life that I have not been able to write about it in a way that was meaningful and made sense and reflected my thoughts. And I look at that and I think that's a huge glaring, like, a mission there in my history, is that, you know, the gay marriage thing was really sort of an unraveling point for me, and I was never able to say it in the way I wanted to say it, because I kept feeling like, if I'm going to write about this and how I feel and how I truly and deeply believe, I have to do it in a way, it was never good enough in my head. And I, you know, I don't know why, but I never made it on the blog. I mean, there were vague allusions and hints to things. And since that, since Prop 8, I think I've been fairly open, you know, to the point where I openly say I support gay marriage. But at the time, I could not write about it. I think if I wrote about it and it was permanent and people could, you know, see it, that I was afraid that if I did that, that it would be real and I would have to confront some things about the church that I wasn't ready to confront yet.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's a great point. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about feminism. Because I don't think of you as a gay rights activist quite as much as I think of you as a delightful ball of feminist fury.
thank you. That is my favorite phrase from now on. I am a delightful ball of feminist fury. That's true.
When did you become so delightfully feministically furious?
Before we go into that, I will say that feminism believes that in my view of feminism, is that it believes in equality for everybody. And
oh, I believe that. I do not believe that, right? These are divergent viewpoints.
No, but people, I'm surprised, okay, will be like, I'm a feminist, but I don't, you know, support gay rights. And I'm like, well, that seems silly, but that's a tangent for another day. I became a ball of feminist fury after I went to the temple to get married. And suddenly I realized that I had sort of believed that patriarchy in the church was sort of a joke. Like, we claim to believe in a patriarchy, like we claim that, you know, Mormons should eat really healthy according to the word of wisdom, and then we serve funeral potatoes. Like, I felt like we claimed that we were a patriarchy but didn't really act on it, because I had absolutely no patriarchal figures in my life growing up. My dad is not a typical Mormon patriarch.
patriarchy light in your household growing up?
Yeah, patriarchy, like, non-existent. I mean, I've always seen my parents work together as co-partners, you know? So I thought that the patriarchy thing was just, I don't know, some weird traditional thing that we kind of talk about, but nobody really believes. And, you know, and then I went through the temple and I realized that patriarchy is a very vital doctrine in the LDS church. And I mean,
vital in the Latin root.
Cannot
alive.
Live without. Yeah.
Yes.
Know? And I mean, I know that the obvious question to that was like, well, didn't you notice that, you know, all leaders in the church were men? And, you know, and I guess so, but I just kind of thought, I don't know, I think that was in my time where I was trying really hard to be a good Mormon. So I believed like the, oh, men have the priesthood because women are so spiritual and we have babies or something. So I don't know.
It occurs to me that that's the first time that your Venn diagram really intersects with that, because the brethren are over there and you're over here and your dad is a nice guy and he is not lording it over you or whatever, or over
right.
your mom. And you go to the temple and all of a sudden your Venn diagram just got patriarchalized. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You raised your hand and said, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And it also, you know, I became a raging ball of feminist fury out of a broken heart. Sheesh.
Was that immediate?
Because
you're going through the temple, and how, I mean, how many days later were you getting married, or was it even that same day?
It was a month and a half later, and...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a long...
I had a long time to sit and stew about that, and...
Did your blushing groom-to-be know that you were stewing about that?
He knew I was stewing about it. He didn't quite understand the implications in his mind. It was an implied thing. Like, you hearken unto your husband, but it was implied that he would hearken unto me. And I was thinking, if it's not said in this most important thing that you do in your life, then if it's not said, then how important can it really be, you know? But,
yeah.
You know, that was something, I mean, that we were navigating and that we still are navigating. But at the time, you know, it didn't, he understood that I was going through something, but he thought it would eventually resolve itself. And I thought it would resolve itself too. I mean, I feel like I'm painting Dan as this sort of like oblivious person, but in all honesty, I would say things like, that really bugs me, but I'm going to resolve it. So he wasn't super concerned, but man, that just, it broke my heart, you know, and I've never recovered from that. And I've never forgiven. I don't think I will for a really long time. I've never forgiven, I don't know, whoever's in charge, because I don't think it's God, but I've never forgiven whoever, the Masons, you know,
who
set that up. And that's, I got, you know, at first I was heartbroken, and then I've noticed a pattern. When I'm heartbroken, my next step is just rage. Like, hell hath no fury. Like a heartbroken Stephanie Child bride. And that's where it started. I mean, it started when I was 20 and I heard those words for the first time and, you know, never gone back from there, really.
It occurs to me that in all the best scenarios of preparing someone to go through the temple where you're like, well, we're going to talk about Adam and Eve and it's really symbolic and you're going to have these temple clothes and where somebody really, really prepares you, that unless you have a very, very feminist mother who is also has somehow, I don't know how that works, but unless you have a feminist mother who says, and sweetie, they're going to say this stuff. Nobody is usually going to, I don't think, on the boards, people tell me if I'm wrong. Are you preparing your daughters and saying you're going to subjugate yourself to your husband as an eternal principle in the temple, and that's a preparation piece? Because it sounds like that took you by surprise.
Oh, it totally took me by surprise, which is bizarre, because I mean, I you don't become a feminist ball of raging fury overnight. So the temple might have been the catalyst, but I was raised by a very feminist mother. I mean, that's where it got in there, is my mom's always been a very feminist person. And in all honesty, I think the temple, because I looked at her, I remember looking over and looking at her, and she saw the look on my face, and I saw the look on her face, and she knew. She knew what was happening. She said something along the lines to me of saying, there's this funny phrase, the man might be, I think it was from my Big Fat Greek Wedding, the man might be the head, but you're the neck. And I think she was trying to tell me, because we talked about it a little bit afterwards, that, despite what they say, you and Dan are going to work together, that that's not what you're expected to do. And I don't think my mom realized that I get my ignore it and make it work for you mentality from my mom. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but she had taken that principle and said, that doesn't work for me. I'm going to change it so that it works for me. And there's nothing more feminist than that, than saying this doesn't work and I'm going to change it. But I don't think she's taken it to the step where, instead of doing that, why don't we just change the language? Why don't we change the doctrine? Why don't we realize that this is not what God wants, But it was, I was totally unprepared. I was completely unprepared because that wasn't something that bothered my mom. And this is entirely possible, my mom was hoping I wouldn't notice. I think my poor mother has been hoping because, I grew up with a really keen, strong obsession with justice, and we can get into that at another time. But so she would almost shield me from things that were wrong because she'd know I would harp on them because I could not get over it.
If I watched something like on the news where someone did something bad and wasn't caught or, wasn't found or dealt with, I would feel sad for a long time growing up as a kid. So my mom started shielding me from things a little bit because she knew it would bug me and I wouldn't be able to understand that lack of justice. That's something I still deal with as an adult to a lesser extent. But so I think she was hoping that I wouldn't notice it because she knew it would bug me. Like she knew going in and was just hoping, or that I would be able to work it out on my own. And she did that because the church means a lot to her.
Yeah.
And she wanted me to be able to have it mean a lot to me, despite glaring deficiencies. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if that's what I would do with my kid, but she was trying to make it work for me. And I love her for that and appreciate her for that, And I think maybe by also not talking about it, she was saying it was something that wasn't important and that I could ignore. Like, just ignore it. It's not important. But, that obviously didn't work for me.
Okay. All right. How did that begin? So that's an epiphanic moment, right? You have this moment of clarity. Ironically, just as you are moving into ostensibly the prime patriarchal relationship of your life, which I don't believe at all you and Dan have that kind of relationship,
but no.
It's framed that way for you. It's even framed that way for you in the sealing ceremony and in the husband taking you through the veil and all of that.
Right.
So where did you go from there?
After the temple, I mean, I went through with it. I got married to him in the temple. After that, though, I mean, once you realize that it is a patriarchy, that it isn't some just weird thing that people sort of passingly give lip service to, you start to see it everywhere. You start to see it in every phrase that the church uses about women and, all over the place. And, it took a long time, but my reaction to it grew so strong that I could no longer I could no longer function within the church, you know? And it was hard. It was hard on our marriage and our relationship, because while Dan is a very true believing person, he was not raised by true believing people. And he is very open-minded in a lot of ways. I mean, that was one of my major appeals, was that here was a person who is kind and wonderful, but also Mormon. And I almost, you know, I would look at him and think, he can do it, and so I can do it too. And when I couldn't do it anymore, I think there were levels of betrayal for both of us. I felt like I had betrayed him, that I had made a promise to him that I could be this active Mormon person and we'd go through, you know, this journey to the celestial kingdom together. So I think I felt like I'd betrayed him.
You changed the rules on him.
Yeah, and I felt very bad for almost, I felt like I'd manipulated him, but I didn't know, you know, and that's what I always come back to. I didn't know that this would happen to me. And then Dan, I think in turn maybe felt a little bit betrayed too. Like, hey, wait, we had this plan and you changed it without even talking to me. You know, like, that isn't very equally, even if you want to say, like, I believe in equal partners, it's not maybe very equal partnering to suddenly be like, hey, I'm dropping out, you know. Where we've gone from there, you know.
Now, that was what year? How long ago was that?
Let's see. Sorry. I was maybe...
2006?
Yeah. Well, no, wait, hold on. I was married in 2007.
Okay. And Prop 8 was the next year.
Yeah, right? I mean, I'm getting my...
And in 2007. Right? All of this seems to be happening sort of at the same time.
Yeah. And so it did, though, I will say there was a time after I got married where I decided to ignore everything that I possibly could and try the best I could. I would ignore the temple thing. I would do basically what my mom suggested. I would ignore the stuff in the temple. The gay thing sort of subsided after Prop 8. It was easier to deal with when it wasn't like over the pulpit all the time or a topic of conversation for a lot of people. So I kind of put a timetable. I just sort of put it aside because I was newly married. I was in graduate school. Dan was having some health problems. And so I kind of just put it, I would deal with that later. It was like a total Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, like, yeah. I don't need to deal with this right now, so I won't.
Or even just the proverbial Mormon shelf, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I kind of deliberately distanced myself from things that would maybe trigger those feelings. You know, I'm not saying I like was enjoying church or even believing any of it, but I was shelving it. And that went on for a long time. In fact, it went on until, see, I'm so bad with dates. When the October conference session where Elder Packer got up and said, you know, why would God make people that way?
October of 2010.
Yeah. So if you think about it chronologically, like I went through 3 years of playing the game and, okay. You know, I don't know. In retrospect, I do feel vaguely ashamed of that in a way, because I don't feel like I was maybe being 100% true to myself. But I mean, like I said, we had bigger fish to fry, you know, like Dan was sick. We had bigger fish to fry.
More immediate.
Yeah.
Pressing things.
Yeah.
Life.
Exactly. I was student teaching. I was in graduate school. It was easy to just sort of zone out for 3 hours. Well, by then I was skipping Sunday school at least. But then to deal with these issues. But then, you know, that was another like just heartbreaking moment. I remember, you know, I was kind of ignoring conference deliberately. I don't know, maybe my psyche somehow just knew that this was going to be bad. But like I stumbled upon, I think, an open thread on like by common consent or something. And they were like, are you hearing this? Is anybody hearing this? And I thought like, oh no, what's happened? And I, you know, heard about what was going on and what he'd said. And then I read about it later and read the quotes and all of the transcripts and stuff. And that was a major breaking point for me where I couldn't shelve it. I couldn't ignore it anymore. And that by doing so, I was hurting myself by ignoring it because I wasn't being true. I wasn't living a true life. And I was hurting myself by ignoring it. But not only was I hurting myself by ignoring it, but I was hurting other people.
Did you feel like you were complicit by being by that?
Yeah. Okay. I felt like if I didn't start saying something, that I was inadvertently supporting it, that if I let people believe that I was just, you know, going with it and fine with it, it would be hurting other people. And I'd be hurting myself. I'd be hurting others. I would be hurting women. I would be hurting gay people. I would be hurting everyone, because everyone is negatively affected by patriarchy, and everyone is negatively affected by prejudice and intolerance. And I couldn't do it anymore. You know, I could not do it anymore. I couldn't say this is okay, or we'll deal with this later. It was something that we have to deal with now. And that's kind of where I went. And I don't, you know, things were festering, obviously, for 3 years. But I, you know, the temple and the Packer talk were major unravelings for me.
How many times did you go to the temple? How many times have you been to the temple? I'm curious.
It's an embarrassing number. Like, I probably less than 10. I never really went. I mean, we went a couple times a year, maybe. So 3 years, couple times a year.
It's hard.
Think I've been.
When you have this terrible visceral experience, it's hard to imagine going back. I'm always curious.
Yeah, I went back a few times, mostly out of social obligation. My grandparents were leaving on a mission, and they wanted all of the endowed people to go through in the family to do a temple session together. I remember I went to that, and it was painful. Oh gosh, total full endowment sessions? I don't know. Maybe 4 or 5 endowments, a couple of initiatories, and then the obligatory weddings for my sister, and a couple random family members. So, for anyone wondering, like, well, how can you disagree with the temple if you haven't been a bunch of times? You know, it's not as secretive as people think. Like, you can find information if you want.
I want to gently suggest that certain things seared themselves into your brain,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that whole thing. Like, you're never going to forget the moment when someone tells you something like that. I mean, I get that it's a meaningful experience for a lot of people, so I still... and very hesitant to like openly talk about it or bash it. But, you know, we all know, right? Like, everyone listening knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, not everybody, but I mean, you know, yeah. Google still exists.
Google, so, the internet will help you.
Okay, so this last year then, I mean, this is really, so what has happened in the last year? And we need to talk about the life brewing within you.
Oh, yeah. The fetus. I got bored. That's the short story. I got bored one summer, so I decided to give this a shot. It's weird how you make decisions when you no longer make them in a Mormon context. But we're skipping ahead a little bit. Let's see. In the last year, I think I decided I went and cleaned out everything. And initially, it started by rejecting everything, you know, rejecting anything associated with church. And I was very, very, very angry. I was very angry because I felt betrayed by my upbringing. I felt betrayed a little bit. I felt betrayed by God a lot, you know, and I rejected everything, and I was very angry. I think you can see that a little bit in my writing, you know, that there's a lot of anger there. I remember
it's such charismatic anger, though, that it's hard to get too worked up about.
Well, I'm good at funny anger.
Yeah.
But I was very angry and upset. And what I was most upset about, who I was most upset at, was myself. I was upset that I could not go back to being my kind of quirky but still very believing Mormon self. And I was angry at myself that I couldn't let it go entirely and just, you know, let it go. I was angry at myself for not being able to, like, do something about that. And I desperately wanted to be able to go back, you know. I wanted to find a way to make it work again. I wanted to do that for myself, and I wanted to do that for my family, and I wanted to do that for my spouse. And there was a lot of grief there. Later, and I don't know how I came to this epiphany, but I do relate a lot to leaving traditional Mormonism as a grief process. It's a death. And maybe this ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning. It was a death of the original Stephanie Lauritsen. That person died. And whoever is now here is a different person. And navigating that death of the formal self, I had to grieve that.
Well, in Mormonism, we have a very, and in Christianity in general, we have a very strong metaphor of rebirth.
Yeah.
As a process of life.
Yeah. And I felt that starting to happen because even though I was angry, I couldn't stop holding on to certain things. Like, I couldn't let go of God. And I'm not saying that's the response everyone has, but I couldn't let go of God. I couldn't let go of the relationship I built, you know? And so I just, in when you talk about losing someone, you talk about accepting in death or in grief. You talk about the new normal, how you have to develop a new normal for you that is different from the old normal. And I realized that for me, my new normal is that I will always, always, always be questioning and criticizing and interacting with Mormonism in some form or another. I'm never going to go back to being my true believing self. Likewise, I don't think I will ever be able to let it go to the point where it plays no role in my life, not as long as I'm married to spouse man, which I still believe I will be with him forever. Despite
good, because he's an awfully nice guy, and you're awfully nice. And
yeah,
I'd like to see you together forever.
Well, and I'd like to see someone try and make us not be. So
exactly.
Right. Woo! You know,
that's exactly right.
Good luck with that.
Yeah,
old white guys.
Another fantastic way to frame it. You're really helping me with, you're giving me therapy this morning.
That's good. I feel like we're mutually benefiting. But, and so that's my, that gave me some peace knowing that my new normal is questioning and it's not a happy place sometimes. And it's very, very difficult because it's much easier to just accept and believe or shelf or not believe, you know, and just reject all of it. And those are legitimate choices for people, but they're less complicated on a lot of levels. And so I've chosen a very complicated path, but that's my new normal. And that's okay. For a long time, I beat myself up about it. And now I realize that it's okay. There can be things that I like that I got from my Mormon heritage that I appreciate and that I like. There can even be ideas that I like, but there can also be things that I dislike that I know aren't true and that I don't believe anymore. And I wrote about it in the idea that I had to create a new God, you know, because gods always behave like the people who make them. And I, you know,
ironic.
Yeah. And I've been building that new God and trying to figure out who God is for me and working with that instead of the patriarchal Mormon God who I openly no longer believe in, you know, but I don't know. That's sort of where I am now, is that I am openly questioning things.
And with your delightful husband, how is that conversation working itself out?
Well, there have been phases of that, like levels of grief, in which Dan was also very angry and had a right to be angry.
Angry with you? Angry with what? Where was his anger directed?
Towards the situation, you know, like, how did this happen? How did this situation happen? And towards me, and maybe you're not supposed to say that, but he was angry at me, and, you know, that's okay. You know, he was never angry in a, you know, mean abusive way, but he was angry at me, and that's normal. I mean, married people are occasionally angry. I was very angry at him a lot of the time for still accepting ideas that, you know, seemed very wrong to me. So we went through a phase of where we were very angry at each other. later, though, I think what we've come to is that our marriage is more important than the differences that we have in our marriage, you know, and we didn't marry solely because of the Mormon church or because of religious beliefs. This wasn't, I think, a situation where we looked at each other and said, you're young, Mormon, and single, and I'm young, Mormon, and single, therefore this will work.
You'll do.
Yeah, like, okay, well, you know, you went on a mission, and, oh, you haven't had sex with anyone, so let's do this.
Right.
And I think a breaking point for both of us was when we decided that we loved each other enough to accept that we're going to have different ideas and that we're going to work with those. I do think a major turning point, though, was Dan and I had to let go of some of that frustration and stop trying to force it on other people, on each other.
On each other.
Yeah, and we had to, you know, and I think Dan has had to loosen up a little bit because he knows that if he's not accommodating of what I'm going through, that our marriage will suffer. And I have to accept that if I am not accommodating for what he is going through, our marriage will suffer. And so we've both had to loosen up in a lot of ways. I've had to accept that Dan is always going to be a very faithful and believing Mormon. And I think Dan has had to accept that I am not. I mean, I think it's an everyday navigation thing. We have to navigate that every single day. You know, there's no happy, like, wrapped up ending, but it's a work in progress. And I think I'm glad that he is still so faithful because it allowed me to hold on to the things that I love. And I am significantly grateful to him for that. You know, it would have been easy for me to just say to lose everything. And he gave some of those things back to me that I love. You know, I love the concept of prayer. Whether they are there or not, that's irrelevant to me. I love the idea of loving celestial parents who want us to be happy. And I love the idea of a savior. And it doesn't matter to me if that's just an idea. I love that I can have those ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dan brought those back for me. So I am grateful for that. And, you know, and he's been through a lot. This is hard for him. This is, I think, incredibly difficult for him. And for the most part, with occasional lapses on both parts, on both our parts into douchebaggery, because we both went there, he's handled this with a lot of grace. And I'd like to think that I've given him some stuff too. I mean, we've talked about the things that hurt me, and he's acknowledged them. And I think that will help us be better parents in the long run. I think he sees that despite the good stuff he clings to, there are some painful things. And knowing that will help us with ourselves, with others, and, you know, with this kid. So
let's talk about this kid. You are quite intimate right now with a female human fetus.
Yeah, we've got a girl in here. That was fraught with issues for me, but here she is.
Or here she's coming. How?
Yeah.
You're going to raise this child and in an interesting environment.
Definitely.
Tell us about that.
Well, I mentioned before, but to you, but not to everyone else, that I had kind of a freak out last week about that because I felt like, and I've talked about this before, I felt like sometimes for a Mormon woman, if you raise a daughter in the church or a son, but especially a daughter, due to the nature of patriarchy, you are feeding your child to a monster. And, you know, I compare it to the Greek myth, and I don't remember the names or whatever myth, that we have the constellation for. They tie her onto the rock so the monster eats her and doesn't tear through the community. And I feel sort of like raising a daughter in a Mormon patriarchal environment is doing the same thing.
Like a virgin sacrifice.
Yeah, that you're sacrificing this girl who doesn't know anything to this life of submission, because that's what patriarchy is. And I'm deeply, deeply uncomfortable with that. And I can't do it, and I won't do it. But on another level, the world is patriarchal. And so while having our child say, you know, have nothing to do with the church, would avoid that part of the patriarchy, it's not going to avoid the world. And something that we've talked about is how we need to acknowledge that the world is patriarchal and give our child the tools to deal with it and hopefully change it and be an active force for solutions. And so that gave me a lot of peace to say, okay, you know, it sucks that the world is patriarchal. It sucks that my daughter's going to have to fight that. But we will be here to give her the resources and the tools to do so. And as far as the church goes, though, that's going to involve a whole lot of compromise. One of which was that we've talked about, I'm not going to have her participate in something that I feel that makes me uncomfortable because I feel like it's wrong, and that when she gets bigger, she won't be forced to participate in things that make her feel uncomfortable or that she thinks is wrong. But
do you have any specific examples of those things?
Yeah, like if she doesn't want to, if she doesn't want to get married in the temple, there's going to be no outside pressure from us. And if we have a son and or a daughter and they have no interest in serving a mission, that's not going to be an issue for us. But then even little small things like participating in fundraisers so that the scouts can go do something scouty, stuff like that. And she, if she wants to go talk to her bishop and have a girl there, a woman there, or another advocate, you know, she can. And
I'm curious as to whether you will insist on that or whether you will leave that up to her.
When she's smaller, you know, like I'm trying to think of the time frame for things. I mean, I think your parents are there when you do a baptism interview.
No, not necessarily. I don't think
so. You know, we would talk to her about that and say, you know, we think it's sort of weird for this old guy to be in a room with you with the door shut, because we think that's weird if any adult is doing that, regardless of religion. So I think when we were little, we would be insisting on being there. I don't want to leave my 8-year-old daughter with any weird males, Mormon, not Mormon, whatever. Or weird females, frankly. I'll go both ways. I think we will be there to offer to act as a guide in the beginning, so that she knows when she's older and maybe, I can't see the future. So for me, it's very difficult to imagine a daughter going in for a temple recommend interview, because that's not part of my life. But I imagine maybe that's something that she would be interested in doing. But we would give her the tools when she's young to say, okay, I do want to, if I want a temple recommend, then I will ask for my young women's leader or my mom or my dad or someone to be in there with me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, teaching her how to advocate for herself in a meaningful way. Recently, our bishop asked, he talks to me and asks me if I am comfortable with Dan accepting time intense callings, because he knows that that's an issue that I have, that Dan, sometimes I feel like the mistress and Dan and the church is the wife, because the church requires so much. And so he actually talked to me before extending a calling to Dan saying, hey, you know, given your situation, but that's because I knew how to advocate for that for myself. You know, I wasn't going to let the church take my husband away from me. You know, and of course that was a conversation I also had with Dan saying, look, I'm not comfortable with you being first counselor in the bishopric, because, you know, I have issues with the church as a whole, but I also have an issue with you not being here, you know, when we're about to add a new, very time-consuming member of our family. And so, you know, but I had to learn how to advocate for myself for those things. And I hope that's something we can teach her to do too. And I think, you know, for Dan, I think he wants there are lots of ways to be Mormon. I think that's what we want to teach our kids, is that there are lots of ways to be Mormon. They can be like dad if they want to be. They can be like mom if they want to be. They can be who they are in the Mormon church, and that there's not going to be labels or, you know what, am I making sense? She gets to claim
absolutely, and
womanhood.
I want to firmly underline when you say be like dad or be like mom, that mm-hmm. your children are doubly blessed because both of those role models are fabulous people that are thoughtful and kind and willing to be generous in assumptions and generous in this conversation. So I have the most hope possible for your children to be in a good place there. I want to say that as the highest compliment I possibly could to you.
Thank you, Greg. I mean, that means a lot to me. But our little daughter will claim her own Mormonhood. And that's what I think, you know, you don't have to learn everything from every life experience. But if there was something to be learned from the navigating that Dan and I have had to go through, it's that she will claim her own Mormonhood, whatever that looks like. And if that ends up being non-Mormonhood, she will claim that too.
Excellent.
You know,
let's just wrap up with a couple of things, unless you have major other issues that we, you know, that you wanted to make sure we touch on. I want to ask you about justice. You intimated to justice a little earlier and your feelings about justice.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. Talk to me about, I'm always interested in justice versus fairness.
Right.
But I'd be interested to know kind of where your feelings touch on that subject.
Well, that's a deeper psychological issue that I think stems back from the fact that I have ADD and the host of spectrum things that go with that, you know? And so I am on the autistic spectrum somewhere. I'm obviously super high functioning and awesome. But one of the things that can be very difficult for people with spectrum, I don't like to say issues because it's not a negative thing for me, but who...
It's just a thing.
Yeah,
it's
who
just
work
you.
On the spectrum, people who work on the spectrum often tend to lean towards black and white.
Yeah.
And we don't do nuances very well. I mean, I've had to train myself to be a nuanced person. And I think everybody has to do that, but maybe people working on the spectrum might have to work a teeny bit harder. So justice was something, even from a very, very young age, I was very into justice and even the idea of revenge. And imagine a very adorable little six-year-old hyper-focusing on the concept of revenge. I was a weird, weird kid. But later, my sense of justice, it's still tied into my idea of what is right and wrong, you know, and I can understand that life is not fair sometimes. It's not fair that you get in a car accident that wasn't your fault and something tragic happens to you. That's not right. Fair, and we can't control that. I understand that, I think. But justice to me, you can control, or you can try to control justice. We don't have to live in an unjust world. We have to live in an unfair world where bad things happen to good people and vice versa.
Let me try to add a little bit of nuance to that. It's sure. Not that we do have to live in an unjust world mm-hmm. because the world is unjust.
Right.
But we don't have to accept it.
Right.
And we don't have to say that we won't work to try to make it better.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that we have a choice, even if it's never successful. I mean, I imagine that the world will always be unjust, but we can always choose to push back against that injustice. So when I would see things like with the issues the church has had with the gay community and with, you know, women's issues,
And I see people say, well, that's obviously the way God wants it because that's the way it is. I don't believe that. I believe God wants us to go against injustice. And if it's not God, I believe that there's something innate in the human spirit that says we have to fight against injustice.
Thank you. This is what liberals think.
Yes.
So when you think that liberals are concerned with fairness and you've been taught a caricature of liberalism that is not correct, liberals are concerned with justice as a function of doing what Jesus did.
Absolutely.
And I just want that to be underlined several times so that we can start to understand each other from a conservative to liberal spectrum, because this is the root, I believe, of liberal thought.
I totally agree. You know, and I think there are lots of closeted liberals who don't even know that they're liberals because...
They've been taught the Glenn Beck caricature of liberalism of, you know, a government that controls you or whatever, not the idea of being concerned about trying to make the world a better place through addressing issues of injustice.
Right, right.
Anyway, okay, that was my little soapbox.
No, that's a great soapbox. I fully endorse that soapbox.
Okay, let's talk about I almost want to wrap up with this, and if you don't want to wrap up with this, that's okay. I want to talk about, you get messages because of your blog,
mm-hmm.
of people trying to save you.
Yes, I do.
How do you feel about that?
Well, as someone who tries to fix the impossible injustice, I admire their concerted efforts. Because
right.
I get that it comes from a place of absolute like love and concern, but I also have gotten messages. The saving ones are a little bit irritating depending on the tone, and tone means everything. There are some sincere people who sincerely want me to be happy and feel like I can't unless I change certain perspectives. And to those
people, and you're an English teacher, tone is a big deal.
Right. And it's like, you know, bless you, child or person. You know, but it's not going to happen that way. And then there are people who want me to change because I make them uncomfortable. And, you know, they want me to change because as long as I'm existing and in some way quasi-representing what it could be like to be a Mormon, that threatens their paradigm and they don't like that at all. Like all of the women who think that I hate, or men, who think that I hate stay-at-home moms, I think that comes from a place where I'm saying there's lots of choices. You don't have to, you can be whatever you want. And that threatens them because maybe I think they believe that God has said, no, the one way to do this is to be a stay-at-home mom. And so they see me as a threat to the lifestyle that they believe in. And so, and that scares them. And I understand that. And I even sympathize with that. But those people, when they write, their tone is different. And it's like, you have to change, or you have to leave the church, or, you know, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And I don't know, that deeply upsets me. One, because usually they're kind of mean about it. But two, because I wish, if there's one major thing that I wish people could see, is that there are lots of ways to do this human experience and to do this human Mormon experience, you know. And then the short answer is just, you know, F off haters, but that's sort of immature, so you know.
Yeah, that's so this has really been a really fantastic conversation. I'm so happy about it. Is there anything else that you feel like just needs to get on the record here?
No, I think I've covered it. I love stay-at-home moms. I love gay people. I love everyone, which is what I also think God does. So that's it. That's the Mormon child bride philosophy. I might not like you, but you know.
Well, thank you so much. And this discussion will continue on the website, and we'll talk to you later. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening, everyone.
It's been fabulous.
Cool.
The host for today's episode of Mormon Expression Voices was Greg Rockwell. Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C. And the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse. And I